Yumi Steins here. On Ladies We Need to Talk, I speak to women about the big things that are going on in their lives. From overcoming health challenges.
She said to me, "Have you ever heard of the word endometriosis?" And I remember saying, "No, I don't think I have."
To navigating relationships.
I just said to him, "I need a break from you."
Search Ladies We Need to Talk on the Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome back to History or Hoarding. I'm Annabelle Crabb. There's a classic dilemma that rears its head every now and again for everyone in the business of historical hoarding. We know that every object tells a story, but what if it's a terrible story? What if it's a story you can't hide away on some forgotten shelf because it's stamped all over your front door? Okay, outside the State Library of New South Wales, there's a lot of traffic. It's next door to the State Parliament. It's up the street from the Opera House. The Botanic Gardens are right next door. It's right in the middle of everything. The building itself is monumental. Built out of Maroubra sandstone in the Greek Revival style. This building, it looks ancient, even though in reality, it's barely a day over 74.
It was built deliberately to look grand and old, but yeah. It's not. There's a woman that just walked past us that's older than this entrance.
So that's Damien Webb. He works here, and he's helping to organise the library's 200th anniversary celebrations. Now, Damien's a Palawa man whose ancestors have been knocking around on this continent for millennia. So part of him obviously finds the celebration of 200 years, on one level, kind of adorable.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you stack it up against even the conservative odd, you know, estimates of 30,000 years, it's a very, very small blip. But it's one of the first institutions to hit this milestone in Australia.
Right,
so
okay.
It's fascinating to me to see how we deal with our own history as an institution that ostensibly deals with everyone else's.
So as part of that, Damien spent a heap of time investigating the library's historic front doors. The giant, heavy bronze doors that adorn the front of Australia's oldest library. About 1 million people a year walk through these doors. I've walked through them a bunch of times myself, and I've never looked at them.
Oh, my God, same. So the bronze doors that sit outside the library, they're kind of one of those things you stop noticing after a while, and they're always open, so they tend to fade into the background a little.
But these decorative bronze doors are artefacts in their own right. When they were installed in 1942... the library became the first Australian institution to use images of Aboriginal people in its exterior design. At the time, the decision was condemned in some quarters as woke madness. But today, some think they should be taken down for entirely different reasons.
So you've
got the three sets of bronze doors.
Yeah, three sets.
Each set has two doors. They're huge, much higher than a person, much higher than a normal door. And for each door, picture it almost like a chocolate bar divided into all of these squares, each of which features a sculptured image cast in the bronze, in quite high relief so you can run your fingers over it.
The central set depicts explorers and ships.
All the big names are there. There's Matthew Flinders. Anyway, everyone's a white dude. And most of them have beards.
Everyone on these panels in the centre has a name. These are testaments or memorials to individuals that have a story.
But on either side of those central doors are two other sets of doors. And these are the doors through which everybody normally enters and leaves. And the panels on these doors, they depict First Nations people. There's one of a man throwing a spear and another of a man with a dead kangaroo on his back. And there are scenes with women and children. There's actually more than 40 people depicted on these doors, and they don't have names.
These are all just people defined by activity and imagery.
And a quick word of warning here. Some of the historical terms used on these doors are pretty offensive.
And we even have words like labra carved into it.
Are you joking, really? Now, that's a word that was used for Aboriginal women in colonial times.
There's evidence to suggest it started as an Aboriginal word in some capacity, but it becomes this dehumanising word that's just used a lot throughout the early 1900s. So this is a labra with fishnet, Stuart River.
So looking here at a woman carrying a basket, she's wearing a kind of a loincloth sort of a thing, and she's carrying a little child.
Yeah.
For years, Damien walked through these doors with a kind of complicated indifference.
The doors, I'd always kind of noted them and I didn't love the word labra on them. I referred to them within the team as the labradors because it's a cuter way of... It sounds like a dog, but...
I just got that.
Yeah, that's it.
A bit slow. But this past year, with the 200th anniversary right around the corner, Damien stopped just walking through these doors and started asking some questions about them. Those questions led him deep into the history of this library, because doors have always been a subject of controversy for the institution. Today it's about what's on them. But when the library was established 200 years ago, it was more about who was allowed to walk through them.
So, end of February 1826.
We're in Sydney, in a pub.
Where all good ideas spring from.
Which pub, though?
The Sydney Hotel, corner of what is now Grosvenor and George Street.
Our narrator here is Richard Neville, Mitchell Librarian. He's written a history of the library. Outside the Sydney Hotel that day, the colony of New South Wales is barely 40 years old. The brutal business of invasion is still unfolding across the continent. Sydney is full of felons and soldiers. It runs on British currency, promissory notes, and rum.
Probably smelled terrible as well.
But inside the Sydney Hotel, 10 of the city's most prominent gentlemen have gathered to discuss an aspirational dream.
In the technical sense of the word gentleman, in other words, people who saw themselves as part of the colonial elite.
Men with money.
Lawyers, merchants and so on.
These men, emboldened by rum and possibility, feel that it's time for Sydney to take the next step. What the colony now needed, they agreed, was an institution of culture and refinement, a place where the intellectual cream of the colony could seek enlightenment, well insulated from the rough barracks and reeking whale oil street lamps of the city's heart. A place for scholars and for books.
Because it must have been extremely boring if you were literate and trapped in a fledgling colony. I can't imagine.
These men decided a library would be their chance to curate a culture, to tell a story that better reflected who they thought they were.
This new colony in the sort of southern hemisphere was actually turning into a genuine city, so the library was that kind of sense.
They wanted to have nice things.
They wanted to have nice things, and they wanted to have everything that a major city should have, and a library was one of those things.
Were they quite drunk when they came up with the idea?
Well, they were probably drunk with power, in a sense. And drunk with their own self-importance.
Look, I'm not going to lie, booze does crop up remarkably regularly in the history of this place.
You know, the first librarian was an alcoholic. Second librarian, although he wasn't known as an alcoholic, did die of alcoholism.
Are librarians drunks?
I don't think I'd choose to answer that question.
But perhaps more than the booze, the defining thing about this new library was that it would only allow a certain type of person through its hallowed doors.
They didn't want everyone to have access to it, so that was the important thing.
What these men created wasn't a public library. It was a subscription library.
The Australian Subscription Library, which is what it was called.
Subscription being a genteel euphemism for...
money. So you had to pay. So you had to pay to belong. There was quite a strong class distinction. And you had to pay £5 to actually join up. And then it was a £2 annual subscription, which the average worker was probably getting £20 a year. So clearly they weren't going to be able to belong, and they wouldn't have been allowed to belong anyway, because there was also this thing called blackballing. This was a very typical thing in English clubs, and they had white balls and black balls, and the current members would sit around and you made a decision whether you thought that person could join, and if you got a certain number of black balls, then you weren't allowed.
Oh, is that where that expression comes from?
Your membership
I have never known.
Yeah.
I always thought it was a bit testicular and I didn't like to inquire.
It often was testicular in a sense. It tended to be men who did it.
Yeah.
But
Was that an open voting procedure? I mean, would people...
No, it was all private.
So you'd put the black ball in the jar in secret.
And it was a real disincentive, particularly in Sydney, where class was a really important part of 19th century Australia. And where you stood on that class spectrum, you couldn't really move out. You kind of could if you had enough money and so on. But if you were feeling a little uncertain, you know, maybe your mother was a convict or your grandfather was a convict or something.
Or if you had a difficult wife.
Yeah, anything, really. You could be blackballed and that would be embarrassing. Women couldn't belong, so that was the other thing.
Of course not, yeah.
So there are always these kind of social boundaries around who they thought could actually be members.
Exclusivity is written in.
Exclusivity is all very nice as long as you're part of the chosen few. But in bread and butter terms, it's quite hard to make a go of a subscription business when you've decided to exclude just about everyone.
Look, it could never work. Their first meeting, I think they had 95 members signed up. 1829, a lot of those members had dropped away. They could never attract members. They could never find a premises. So if you wanted to find the library, you kept on moving around.
The first library was a shared premises with a pharmacy. The pharmacist was a part-time librarian, also a full-time drunk.
So the whole thing was always in debt and it was always struggling. And they were always saying to the government, oh, could you buy us out? Or can you help us? But we won't let people in.
The gentlemen battled on for a tick over 40 years with their costly vision.
And in 1869, they just thought, we can't go on, you know, the minutes of the meeting say there's no future. We can't do it anymore. And so they offer themselves to the government.
The government paid £5,500 for the collection and assets at the library. And in late 1869, the Sydney Free Public Library was born. A library that opened its doors to ordinary citizens, even women. And the library got its first female librarian, Nita Bernice Kibble. There was a teeny bit of fancy footwork involved with her appointment.
So the first woman to be appointed to the State Library of New South Wales sees an ad for library assistants, and she thinks, oh, that'd be good. So she writes in as N.B. Kibble.
N.B. Kibble. N.B. Kibble. If there's a more perfect librarian name, I demand to hear it. In the meantime, I die of joy.
Lo and behold, she's a woman.
so they were thinking
she'd be a man.
Ned Bob.
But she aces the exam and comes first, and so they're a bit of a quandary, so they decide eventually to appoint her.
Nita went on to be principal research librarian for 24 years. Crafty Kibble. But the towering figure of the library in the first half of the 20th century was indisputably Ifold. William Herbert Ifold. Principal librarian for 30 years and a man of many passions.
He's a model, he's an architect, he's an anthropologist.
Also a Rotarian and an obsessive cultivator of roses.
You know, you've even got other government officials saying, I will continue to work with you, but please don't hurl any more abstruse Latin phrases at me on the street. So this man would walk along and yell abstruse Latin phrases at government officials on the street.
Is it wrong that I kind of love it?
It's charming. It would have been a nightmare to work for him. I don't know Ifold, but I definitely came away not being able to love him or hate him, and I assumed I'd be able to fall onto one of those sides. But the more you learn, the more it's just... He's
an impossibly difficult man to pin down. And he was relentless in his campaign for funding to construct a permanent home for the library. It needed to be a new building of suitable grandeur. And by 1940, he kind of won the battle, but winning wasn't enough. He wanted to micromanage the project, and ironically, seeing as most of the library's past controversy had been about who was allowed through the doors of the place, the design element that really blew up popular opinion was the new front doors. This story involves quite a bit more booze, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, I would do a drunk history version of this talk in a heartbeat.
Ifold wanted important doors, statement doors, big, expensive bronze doors that told a story. But in the 1940s, the world had other stories going on. Other uses for bronze, too.
I guess this was happening around wartime, so the idea of finding that much metal and using it for something as decadent as a library door.
Right, this could have been 30 cannon.
Absolutely scrutinised, yeah.
The government isn't going to bankroll Ifold's bronze door fetish. So the crafty librarian goes in search of deep pockets. He goes to William Dixon, a businessman, son of a wealthy tobacco merchant, and, most importantly for our story, he's a collector. He was a deep lover of Australiana. And from the early 1900s, he started giving his stuff to the library. His gear was part of what was going to be housed in this new building.
So Dixon's a big swinging Dixon of the library scene.
Very much. He's also kind of awkward and lifelong bachelor, which, you know, I have my own questions about, and fastidious and nerdy.
And so one day, Ifold, our principal librarian, calls up Dixon and says, "Hey, what you doing?"
And so he took Dixon out for a game of golf.
They went to a course in Killara on Sydney's North Shore, where Ifold deliberately missed a 6-inch putt, giving Dixon the game.
Lost deliberately, got him drunk on whiskey and secured £4,000, I believe.
Wow, that's a lot of money. And once Ifold had the funds, he could advance to phase two of his plan, which was to commission artwork for the library's doors that celebrated people who'd never been depicted on a public building here before. The continent's first people.
So he talks about, you know, this is the first time sculpturally Aboriginal people have been dealt with, and you've seen in museums around the world and libraries around the world, they put their Indians on the doors. Why would we not? The Aboriginal people here are even more awesome, are even more cool.
This was an explosive idea. Correspondents to the Daily Telegraph were incensed by the very proposal. And the library's committee cagily suggested maybe thinking about something safer, something a bit broader and a bit more Western civilization-y. But Ifold could not be moved.
I think he wanted to think that this was something good for Aboriginal people. And you see him and I believe it was one of the curators from the Australian Museum at the time, they have these lines in their letters, like, we cannot forget what our so-called civilization did to these people. So there's this genuinely, like, palpable sense of grief, if not moral outrage.
Ifold wanted to depict Aboriginal people in ways he felt were the most dignified and pure.
Of course, he's only considering desert, traditional, noble savage kind of imagery.
So he digs through the library's own collection of photographs and finds a bunch he thinks might suit, hands them to his preferred sculptor, and work commences on the library's new and formidable public doors, which open in 1942. Smash cut to 8 decades later, when Damien Webb starts to ask questions about the doors.
How we built them, why we built them, what fed into them.
And the images sculpted into them. Now, most of the images on the doors were drawn from photographs taken by someone named Herbert Baisdell, who was a doctor, an anthropologist, and a prolific photographer of Aboriginal Australians in the early 1900s. And these photographs, they're all still in the library.
They're all in a box.
In boxes that are kept deep underground.
You know, I talk about the darkness of the stacks. The lights do turn on. This is a well-equipped building. But you are down, you know, 7 stories into country.
Yeah. Damien, like pretty much everyone who works here, is kind of a part-time detective. And he was pretty eager to uncover these photos. But he wasn't prepared for what exactly he might find.
And I did know better, but I got excited and dove in. And you open these things and it hasn't been culturally curated. So there's nothing on there to indicate what you're about to see. And so you're like, oh, beautiful images of, oh my goodness. Okay, so these are the syphilis research photos.
Because Baisdell was a doctor,
A lot of these original photographs were not so much reference images for an artist, they were more sensitive medical images.
Everything that we would expect, controls around informed consent, ethical use.
And even the ones that aren't medical, they're still deeply cultural and private. Things people wouldn't even take photographs of today, let alone plaster them on a public building.
There's two men on the doors. It looks kind of like, because of the way the plaster and the bronze has simplified things, just kind of looks like they're crouching, talking about something. But as soon as you find the original reference photo, it's a ceremonial venesection. These are men collecting blood from their bodies to create ceremonial objects or belongings, or to do law, both of which are absolutely only the business of people that go through that law.
But now there's the business of 1 million people a year walking through the library's front doors.
What becomes clear from the photos is that what's on the doors is really not something that should be there.
These doors are a solid example of how this library has grown, like a tree with different seasons layered on top of each other. The exclusion and the openness, the theft and the preservation, they're all kind of stuck together now, part of history. You can't really divorce the terrible story from the good intentions.
And this is where they can get problematic for us, because there are collections where, you know, First Nations, a community from around Australia, have said to us, look, we're glad you've got it. Thank God it was collected. But really, it's one of those things that we don't necessarily want to be publicly available to every single person that comes in. A lot of people in our community still look at that as being sensitive, sacred even.
You're hearing a guy called Ronald Briggs and his colleague, Melissa Jackson.
Totally agree with you. At the beginning, I did.
Now, they are two legends of the library. They started working here 35 years ago as the place's first ever Indigenous trainees. Their contribution to public libraries is profound, and their friendship is so magical that they have their own episode, which you'll hear soon. But we're previewing them here because Ronald and Melissa are like a living, breathing demonstration of how attitudes change and how an object like a huge decorative door can go from incredibly progressive to cultural eyesore, even in the course of a single generation, even in the mind of the same person.
So our brass doors, 30 years ago, I thought they were great. And so now we've done the research into, oh, what did they actually depict? Like, they're Aboriginal people, and it's really good. But, wow, look at what they're depicting there. There's these ceremonies and magic and sorcery and all of those types of things. I think that something should be done. We should be at least putting a signage on there to say, you know, this is what this means.
So you're not in the kind of like take the doors down camp?
Take the doors down camp. I am. Because those sections, there are sections, and they can be popped out and put something in there to say there used to be something in here, or tell the story of it or something like that.
The people who were writing those histories in the past were coming at it from a Eurocentric, you know, British Empire perspective.
Yep.
We're coming at it these days more from a an Aboriginal nations perspective, which is refreshing. And we know it's going to change how we're talking about what we're talking about. People are going to think that we're a little bit mad and crazy, and why do we think that way?
Well, that's history, isn't it? It's like an evolution of, you know, going back and having a second look at the things that were omitted the first time round.
Uh-huh. And that's the important part of State Library New South Wales, where we don't throw anything away, because
That sounds messy. I'm just like, I'm a bit of a hoarder myself, but that sounds next level.
And we need to have what was written, what was thought way back then, so that we know that this is where we've come, this is how far we've come for just inclusion into everyday Australian life.
Mm.
but there's a long discussion that needs to be had around what our reply is going to be. And I hope we can take them down and put something in there to say we're listening.
Martin Luther King Jr. famously said that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. And the historic arc of this library may be short in terms of human life on this continent, but it does tell the story of a messy, imperfect attempt to bend towards justice. Doors that started out closed, but slowly opened. Assumptions made by blokes in pubs that went unexamined for a while, but not forever.
We're much more aware now that there's a job to do in terms of being a more accurate reflection, I suppose.
And I actually find it really hopeful to think about what started as essentially a rich book club for men and men with wealth is kicked and pulled and stretched into this thing that is for everyone. Like, yeah, okay, we're not getting everything right and we're actively course correcting with every generation and you know, shifting with Australia's culture as it does. But that's cool.
Next time, we look at the drawbacks of the library's open door policy. The story of a master forger who waltzed right into the reading room and stole some of the library's most precious coins.
It wasn't a case of whether it was legal or not for him to own it. He just had to have it. And he was easy pickings with the state library's collection.
History or Hoarding is made on the lands of the Gadigal people. It's written and presented by me, Annabelle Crabb, with research by Julia O'Shea. Harvey O'Sullivan is our audio engineer. Rachel Cusick is our supervising producer. And Carmel Rooney is our executive producer.